Easter. We're now 3 weeks after Easter. And the readings, you might have noticed, have now given up on the Easter stories. We've worked our way through most of them over the last 3 weeks. So where do we go now? And what our readings do is, the first one that we listen to takes us back to the ministry of Jesus and to that reading from John 10. And the second one that we listened to took us forward to the experience of the church and that reading from Revelation. John 10. In John 10, Jesus picks up an image which had all sorts of echoes for his hearers when he described himself first of all as the door of the sheepfold and then as a good shepherd. We're not really so familiar with shepherds in our own time for that to resonate in the way that it would have resonated for his first hearers. But we are familiar, for example, with the psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd," with Psalm 23, which we echoed in the words of our second hymn, where God is the shepherd who walks with and protects those who seek God's care. Although if we had looked elsewhere in the Old Testament, we would have found also how often the picture of the shepherd is used of the leader, and sometimes of the leader who fails. The prophets condemn the false shepherds, the leaders who had failed leading their sheep, the people, in their moral and religious lives. And the scene from that chapter about the good shepherd in John 10 that we listened to was set in one of the festivals within the Jewish year, the festival of the dedication of the temple. It was a festival that looked back to events that had happened 200 years before the time of Jesus. A time when the Jewish people had, as so often they had been, under the control of foreign rulers, a foreign empire. But when that particular empire had tried to displace the worship of God from the temple, had tried to destroy the practice of the Jewish faith. And some had resisted and had won back the control of the temple and had reinstated worship of God and had achieved some degree of independence. And the festival that was being celebrated, as Jesus said the words that we listened to this morning, the festival of dedication, recalled those events. It was a time of celebration. A time of celebration of renewal and hope and a new beginning. But as so often when we celebrate renewal, it probably carried with it tinges of disappointment. Disappointment that in the long term, things had not changed. Independence was short-lived. Again, the people were now under the control of a foreign power, this time under the Roman Empire. They could never be sure that it might not happen again. They might again not be able to worship God in their own way. And leadership, political and religious, was just as much a mixed bunch as it had always been. Post-renewal blues, you might think. Post-resurrection blues. And so perhaps we can understand why the people come to Jesus and say, "Are you or are you not the Christ? Are you or are you not the Messiah, the person who is going to bring us redemption and set us free to live and worship as we want, destroy our oppressors and put the world to right for good?" So there will be no longer any blues. Are you going to be that sort of shepherd? And Jesus' answer might seem to be remarkably unhelpful, very abrupt. He refuses to say yes, because they would take that simply as a reinforcement of what they expected. And he refuses to say no, because that would be to deny his whole purpose. So what he does is to remind them of what he has been saying in the picture of a shepherd. He had said that the good shepherd is not simply the one who leads the people right. He said the good shepherd is the one who puts their life on the line for the sheep, who one who is ready to die. And as we read that story on this side of Easter, we know that that is precisely what happened. That he did indeed, as good shepherd, have to go the way to death. And so he says his sheep recognise him. Those who recognise that that is the way he went to death. Not the answer to all their problems in the way that they expected, according to the agenda that they lay down. Not someone who could beat the Roman powers at their own game, but one who invited them to follow in the way that he went. And then as we turn to our reading from Revelation, we're taken on a very different journey. The vision that we listen to in Revelation is part of a whole sequence of visions that the author of Revelation struggles to describe. And these visions are not a timetable for the distant future, which is how people have sometimes read and misused Revelation. Instead, they invited the first readers, and they invite us, to look at the world and all its struggles over independence and power and war in a new light. And once again, it is spoken to a people who feel themselves out of control, who feel themselves under the control of powerful voices, powerful forces, which threaten to curtail their freedom, to prevent them from practicing and proclaiming their newfound faith. Those earliest readers of Revelation would not have been able to look on a map and discover that the map makers had thought them important enough to mark with a cross. In fact, they may have rather hoped that people wouldn't have been able to find where they were for fear that that would bring them danger and threat, something that we don't have to anticipate. Revelation was written to small groups of believers scattered round the cities of what is now southwest Turkey. And some of those early believers may have found themselves threatened with organized persecution from the powers that existed. But probably much more common was the daily experience of suspicion, of mockery, of people crossing over to walk at the other side of the road when they saw them, avoiding them, of name-calling, of petty aggravation. They felt themselves powerless, and they must have wondered whether the new Lord in whom they had put their faith really was strong enough to protect them. What was this resurrection in which they had believed all about? if it still left them in a position where they felt vulnerable and threatened. And the vision that John offers to them is of a heavenly court, a heavenly throne room, perhaps mirroring how they would have imagined the Roman emperor as living in far-off Rome. The figure at the centre, the powerhouse, the person who controlled it all, sitting on a throne, surrounded by adoring crowds. The great and mighty, the wheelers and dealers, the people who could have power, clustering round him, trying to show that they belonged and trying to catch his eye and win his favour. And perhaps a little bit further off, the other crowds of those who were straining to catch a glimpse and to show that they also adored him and thought him wonderful. But in John's vision, the figure who sat on the throne was not someone gloriously dressed in royal regalia, not someone covered with jewels and fine garments, not somebody with all the weapons of war who could show how he got to be there, but was a figure almost impossible to describe in words, just as sometimes we can imagine or in dreams see something that defies explanation but conveys so much. The figure whom the visionary whom John sees on the throne is described like a lamb that had been slaughtered, a lamb that was slain. Not a figure of triumphant victory, as we might try and portray a figure of triumphant victory, but a figure of defeat, of failure, of incapacity to be able to do anything at all. The Lamb who represents the crucified Lord. And around the throne, John sees a crowd not of people who are similarly addressed in fine garments and statements of how important they are, but a great crowd of people who are dressed simply in white. And the author discovers that these are those who have suffered because of their faith in Jesus. These are those who, just like those who had read or listened to Revelation, were in the eyes of everybody else and all their neighbours, rejects, despised, objects of scorn, perhaps the victims of civil organised violence or just of local mob violence. And their numbers are so great, there are so many of them, that these little groups of Christians, in towns and villages scattered across, as I said, southwest Turkey, Asia Minor, suddenly imagine that they are, in fact, interconnected with hundreds, with thousands, across the globe and across time. And then there comes that strange promise, which is what binds together our two readings from the New Testament, that the lamb which was slaughtered, that the lamb will shepherd them and lead them to springs of water of life. A lamb acting as a shepherd, a slaughtered lamb acting as a shepherd. What a topsy-turvy, nonsensical world to imagine, and particularly to imagine when you are looking for a solution to all your problems. For the last week, I've been teaching a course for Wesley House in Cambridge. Some of you will perhaps know about Wesley House. It used to be used for the training of ministers for the British Church. But over the last few years, since the British Church no longer wished to use it for that, Wesley has been redirecting its work towards offering a place for study and for worship and for reflection for a much wider audience. And this last fortnight at Wesley, we've been hosting a group of 14 people, mainly ministers, from across the world, although a number from North America, who are working for over a two-year program towards a doctorate in ministry. They're all very experienced ministers from a variety of backgrounds who are now trying to take time to bring together their experience of their work with study of theology, but also of new insights into society and politics and economics and of the Bible, to see whether in a conversation between the two they can discover new resources to help galvanise their ministries and perhaps take their ministries in new directions. And as a group to teach, they have been wonderfully lively and wonderfully enthusiastic. It's been no effort at all for me to try and coax some sort of comments out of them, such as it sometimes is in the classroom. Deeply committed to what the purposes of the course have been. As I say, coming from very different backgrounds. So somebody coming from church planting in the Ivory Coast. Somebody coming from working with ex-gang members in an American city. Somebody coming from working with young people in another American city who are alienated from the conventional church. Some in what we might call normal ministry, or involved in teaching or educating. If I say that it's been hard work, and not just hard work for them, but hard work for me as well, over the last week, that would be an understatement. They're really engaged. And the week that I've spent on them has been looking at the Gospel of John and trying to ask whether the Gospel of John has anything to say in their very different contexts. And I think I have to admit that at the beginning of the week, some of them were rather sceptical. Do we look back to the biblical text, or do we need to look at contemporary resources and contemporary models of how to act in leadership or bring up new insights or what have you? When we finally began drawing together some of the insights on Friday, many different things began to emerge. They were still, of course, different people with different emphases and different backgrounds and different convictions, although they had grown together as a group and learned to listen to each other with respect. But one thing that kept coming through as each one reflected on what they had learned was that John's Gospel keeps asking people to re-examine their assumptions, their expectations, and most of all, their expectations of how God works And where power is to be found? God's power. The Good Shepherd. And as I said, a shepherd is an image of power sometimes in the ancient world. But the Good Shepherd who puts his life on the line for the sheep, ready to die. The bread of life, made available only through the death of Jesus. Jesus saying triumphantly on the cross, "It is finished. The work is done." Just as earlier on during the trial, he had said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, only then my servants would have fought to protect me." Quite rightly, at Easter, we sing that wonderful hymn, "Thine be the glory, risen conquering Son." And sometimes we think that resurrection is a victory that means that we can put the cross, the suffering, the death all to one side. That perhaps God does, after all, work through those sort of shows of dramatic power that the Jews who questioned Jesus were looking for. Deliverance, freedom, conquest over all that is evil or restrictive or bad. But our two readings warn us against that. They remind us that God works through obedience and faithfulness, through suffering and through service to others. And so in these weeks after Easter, we're challenged again to think what it means if our praises join the praises of those who John envisioned around the throne, directed towards the one who accepted death. Resurrection does not cancel out that death. It doesn't allow us to carry on as if it never happened. In the gospel stories that we've listened to over the last few weeks, the risen Jesus is the one who still carries the marks of the cross. And as we read through the pages of Revelation, we discover that for the first readers of this image of heavenly worship by those who had remained faithful, a worship of the Lamb who had suffered death, was not just a source of comfort in the midst of persecution and suffering, although it was that. What it did was to force them to look at the patterns of authority and power in the world around them, and to cry out against the abuse of power, the misuse of power, to reject those who used power or authority to maintain their own status. On Friday morning, the students gave presentations about what they had learnt. And one of them, an Afro-American, ended his presentation by quoting one of the final speeches of Martin Luther King. When Martin Luther King had said that social and racial injustice would never be overcome just by quietly waiting for people to learn a better way of living. Martin Luther King had quoted the words to Nicodemus in John 3, where Jesus had said to Nicodemus, "You must be born again. You don't just get there by following a normal journey. You must be born again." And Luther King had declared, "America, you must be born again." only by a radical rethinking of where power is and how we live and exercise authority, if we have any. Only so can injustice be overcome. And Martin Luther King, of course, paid for his own life for his stance against the abuse of power. And the student who went back to that memory was himself reflecting on the way in which his work among other Afro-American young people showed how much that rebirth was still needed, still had not been achieved. Only by turning upside down all the things that were taken for granted could true life really begin to be discovered. And I think the student was right to go back to Nicodemus 3 and right to reflect on it in the way that he had, not just as a picture of individual change, but as a challenge to the way we think about how we live and the society in which we live. That the vision of Revelation 7, where the centre of the worship is the one who offered his life for others and then became their shepherd, that vision conveys the same message. If you were in church last Sunday, you may have listened to the reading from John 21, where Jesus calls Peter to feed his sheep. And that wasn't just directed to Peter as the sort of model bishop or pope or superintendent, but it was directed to Peter as the model of all who would wish to continue as disciples of the risen Jesus. The model of Jesus as good shepherd is not just a model we have to keep checking that our ministers are living by, but a model that we have to check that we ourselves are living by. A model for us in our service of others. In the way that we live out our lives as individuals, in a way that does not flaunt any status or authority we might have or hope to have or think we have. In a way we model our lives as a community, as a church. In the styles of our behaviour, in our treatment of one another. In the way we behave towards those who do come through that door for the first time, or those we know all so well. Continually asking ourselves whether in the ways that we live and organise ourselves and believe, but treat one another, whether we always mirror the values of the kingdom of Jesus. Kingdom which is not as this world counts kingdom. So that we may not necessarily always be marked on the map, but that we will still be marked in the minds and the knowledge of people who do not always come here. We may still be marked in their imaginations by that cross. Because that they know here they will encounter a different pattern of living together, a different pattern of relationships, and different sorts of attitudes than they may encounter elsewhere. So may we forever seek to join those who were praising the Lamb around his throne. Amen.